So I would like to thank the organizers for having me for this talk that I knew amply in advance of. So I also want to kind of give a little bit of a caveat. I'm very new to this whole using Rydberg atoms as RF sensors. This quantum sensing with Rydberg is a new field to me, so I'm kind of a babe in the woods. So take everything you hear from me here with a grain of salt. I'm probably going to be talking about things that half of you know way more about than me, but this is my kind of intro to it. So this is really just about kind of a proof of concept, trying to use cesium as a low-frequency RF sensor. When we talk low-frequency, we're talking sub-gigahertz, you know, very long wavelengths, like tens of meters wavelength radio frequency. So before I go on, I should mention my collaborators. So this, I'm the theory on this, and there we're ramping up an experiment at the Naval Research Lab, NRL. So my experimental collaborators are Seth Meiselman and Jeff Crunch over there. And then this is also done with my research student, Vanessa Ortiz, who's a midshipman, senior midshipman at the Naval Academy coming in here. So, all right. So, like I said, I'm new to this. So this is my sort of babe in the woods understanding of using Rydberg excitations or Rydberg atom as an RF sensor. So we imagine our system here, and I'm thinking just using cesium as an example, but it could work with many a different Rydberg excitation, where you're doing your standard two photon excitation, starting in this case in the 6s ground state, going through the 6p, and then exciting up to some. I'm choosing the ns state. It could be an nd state. You know, standard two photon excitation there. And then we imagine that we have some RF field that's coupling this nearby, in this case, n-1p state that's down below the ns state. It could be the np state that's sitting up here as well, but imagine we have some sort of RF field that's coupling those two together, right? So when we turn on that RF field, without the RF field, if we were looking at the spectrum, the excitation spectrum here, we'd have, you know, just a standard or single peak of the ns state. But when we turn on this RF field, when the RF field is on, that couples in this n-1 state to that ns state, and we get a Altler-Townes doublet splitting. So those two split apart. And the splitting splitting energy here, the difference between those two, is going to be proportional to the Rabi frequency for this coupling, which is proportional to the amplitude of the RF field. But the thing that's really great about this is because we get a multiplier on that of the dipole moment for that transition. And since we're talking Rydberg here, we know that dipole moments for Rydbergs can be huge, which means that this Altler-Townes splitting can be very sensitive to that RF amplitude. Right? So this gives you a handle on a very sensitive way of being able to measure this RF field. And since we're resonant or near resonant with this transition here, with this RF field, that's partially where this huge sensitivity comes from. Of course, I just said that we're near resonant. You can see there's some scanning capability there. But of course, you know, we don't have especially broadband control if we're just at this NS state. But of course, these are Rydberg systems, so there's lots of different Rydberg states we can choose from. One might even go so far as to say an infinity of them. And so if we want to know what the kind of frequency ranges we could use this for, if we start changing our principal quantum number, if we're just even looking for cesium with this NS n-1p transition, going from principal quantum number 30 all the way up to 100 in this range, we can get a range of frequencies that we're sensitive to from 3 to 200 gigahertz. Is a broadband system. You just have to choose the right Rydberg quantum number, the principal quantum number that you look at. And of course, I am citing this work from 2015 from Jim's group. This is sort of one of my jumping off points, but this is a mature field. There's people all over the place doing this work, like Georg Reithel's group up in, and there's NIST and Boulder is doing some good work. It's all over the place. This was my sort of jumping off point here. So this is my basic understanding of Rydberg atoms as an RF sensor. But one problem is here, like I said, we're interested in our work in trying to get sub-gigahertz, in that 10 to 100 megahertz sort of regime. And it turns out that that's a really hard thing to do. We could go at higher in principal quantum number, but to get to the, like, even 100 gigahertz, we'd have to go up to, like, principal quantum numbers of, like, 200. And then you're in a mess where you're getting lots of different states mixing together, from black body radiation, the local environment, getting up into that n equals 200, 300, 400 sort of principal quantum numbers is just a world we don't want to live in. And I have it on good authority from my experimental colleagues that the lasers involved are things that they don't have and are expensive. So we want to keep into a world where we can still kind of use this range of principal quantum numbers, but try and use a low frequency, or get into the low frequency regime. So now that I've done that, I'm kind of doing a little backwards. So here's the outline for the rest of my talk. I'm going to talk about the DC and AC Stark effect and why this sort of leads to this, some of the issues with trying to do low frequency with these intermediate quantum principal quantum numbers, even in cesium. What's happening there, and then also our kind of solution that we're trying to do here. So then I'm going to talk a little about the theory we use here, the flow K theory that comes out of this, and some of the spectral structures that come out of that. And then a little talk a bit about the spectroscopic methods we're going to use. And fortunately, Luis just talked about this. We're planning on using EIT for our thermal or for our detection scheme with some thermal averaging, because we do want to be in a room temperature gas. It's not a very good widget for the Navy if we have to carry around a, you know, helium cooling system or something like that, or keep a cell down at 10, you know, microkelvin. That's not a very efficient thing to do. So, and then I'll just summarize and say what our future looks like. So, talking about the DC and AC Stark effect. So, if I talking about the DC Stark effect, we're going to take our Rydberg atom. In this case, it's going to be a cesium Rydberg atom, where we have our positive core and our Rydberg electrons. Sort of like, if you're giving a Rydberg talk, at some point you have to show this picture. It's actually legally required. And we're going to put some DC constant electric field on that and see what happens to the energy levels of that. So if I put up my the energy spectrum of cesium here, we can get an idea of it. So the cesium S quantum defect is 4.05. We have the P quantum defect, 4.39. D is 2.47. Of course, there's different quantum defects for different fine structure states, different hyperfine, but we'll just kind of use this as a broad stroke idea. So these are the structure that we're going to look at. And when we turn on this external electric field, of course, the S states couple to the P states couple to the D states, and we start pushing around here. And one thing in cesium we can see here, in this structure, the higher P state, this is the NP state, and this is the NS state, so this is the N minus one P state down here. This is actually a little bit closer in energy, so when we couple those two together with this external field at low fields, we're going to get that the S state gets kind of pushed down in this classic quadratic Stark effect, something that looks a little bit like that. So here's the quadratic Stark effect over these sort of initially fairly small fields of up to about 100 millivolts per centimeter for DC fields. And of course, like I said, the change in our energy, the shift in our energy is quadratic. There should be a minus sign there, of course, because I forgot it. So there's a minus sign there, and then I can get, for, in this case, I'm looking at the 30S cesium state, or the state that's dominated by the 30S state, and we can calculate what the polarizability is in that state, and just like all Rydberg things, it's a pretty big number, 5 × 10⁻⁹ AU. So we get some pretty strong dependence there. But even then, the strong dependence is only all over this sort of like 100 millivolt per centimeter field. So that's the DC Stark effect for small fields. And of course, the picture is not quite as simple as that, because cesium also has this weird thing. So if I look at, here's my S, P, and D series, or Rydberg series involved here. But then if you look at our S-wave quantum defect, it's 4.05, and you'll notice, the clever thing, 4.05 is very close to 4. It has a very small non-integer piece here, which means that right on top of all these S states are the degenerate hydrogenic manifolds in cesium. So cesium has this very nearly accidental degeneracy between the N-4 hydrogenic states and the NS states. So that can kind of play some interesting roles in your Stark structure or any sort of calculations you're doing with the NS states in cesium. And when you include that properly and go along there, you get the classic Stark fan from the nearly degenerate set of states. But very quickly, early on, at these fairly small fields on a few tenths of a volt per centimeter, that Stark fan starts crossing through the NS state. So this right here is the NS state. Then actually that's the F state, the N-4 F state right above the NS state, and then you have the full Stark fan. So you can see the NS state sort of crossing through over there. All these avoided crossings happening all over there. So it's a little bit more complex than just the straight quadratic Stark shift. But for our purposes right now, we're going to be focusing on that very small field region. And of course, if you're doing spectroscopy, we care about the actual transition, in this case, the transition from the 6P to the 30S state. So when we look at that, we're going to get a spectrum. So I'm just showing what I predict the Spurk spectrum to look like. And I actually put like a 20 megahertz line width artificially on this, just so you can kind of see it. Otherwise, it'd be too narrow to actually see. But this is sort of the Stark spectrum we'd expect to see in that transition. Nothing new, nothing especially interesting here. You can see that quadratic behavior kind of happening there, and then there's all these avoided crossings showing up. Right. So that's the DC Stark effect, and why am I talking about this? Well, it's because when we don't want to talk about the AC Stark effect for these very low frequencies, this 10 to 100 megahertz range, you can think about the AC Stark effect with that for these very low frequencies as sort of time averaging the DC Stark effect. So we put this slowly varying, relatively slowly varying, 10 megahertz varying electric field on our atom, and all we're going to do is sort of just follow back and forth along that Stark, DC Stark effect, and we can just do a time averaging on it. Of course, we know that for weak fields, we're going to be time averaging over this very small region here, and if you'll notice, because this is quadratic, right, that quadratic, go back here, because this is quadratic, it's got a very weak low field dependence. So when we do our time average to get an AC effect, AC Stark effect, we get a pretty weak shift for overall, in this case, because it's time average, we're just time averaging a sine squared, so we get an extra factor of 1/2, so we just get an AC Stark effect, again, probably should be a minus sign there, that's 1/4 alpha E squared, so it's still quadratic, and here I put a 3 megahertz, which is a fairly realistic line width for if we're going to use EIT detection here. On here. So what you can see, because of this sort of weak low field dependence, because of that low field quadratic effect, to get a shift that's greater than sort of the width we're expecting to see from the state, you got to go all the way out here to like 10s, 20, 30, 40 millivolts per centimeter, which is not especially great sensitivity. And to see a really nice overall approach and discussion of the sensitivity and the feasibility of using Rydberg atoms as an RF sensor, there's this nice JCVS-B kind of overview of it from Paul Kuhn's group that I've been referencing a lot. And you see in here in this very low region in that paper, you'll find that that it's really hard to make a straight Stark effect or Stark shift Rydberg sensor that does better than existing antenna sensors. They're just not that good. So we wanted to see if we could come up with some way to overcome this. So the real problem comes that we have this weak field dependence at low fields in the DC effect. And if we're going to do some time averaging, since we don't have much dependence up there, we're not going to get much of a shift if we're all the way over there. So how can we fix that? Well, why don't we go somewhere in our Stark spectrum where there's a stronger dependence on the field? So why don't we go to some finite offset DC field? And now we can see that as I vary a field nearby this offset, we're going to get a significant change in my energy shift here. We have a pretty decent slope in that energy as a function of our field strength. Right? And this is just doing a linear approximation. And we're going to care about very small AC amplitude AC fields, so we can think about this just as a linearization. That's nice. Okay, so now we've found a way to get more sensitivity to perturbations in our DC field, and maybe we can get something better. Except for, of course, we all know when we have a linear dependence, if our AC field here is harmonic oscillating, going through a sinusoidal oscillation, of course, when I do our time average, any of the sinusoidal oscillation will cancel out, and we'll just get exactly the DC. So there's the end of my talk. We don't get anything, and we're all done. Of course, that's not everything. So to actually understand what's happening with this field offset, with this linear, approximately linear energy dependence as a function of this AC perturbing field, we have to get a little bit more fancy than just time averaging. Where are you there? Oh, wow. I did not time this talk very well at all. Okay. So how are we going to do this? So the way we actually approach this is through a Floquet theory. So what is Floquet theory? When you have a Hamiltonian that is periodic in nature and has a whole bunch of Fourier components, you can take your wave function and take the time dependence and break it into Fourier components. And it turns out when you do that, each Fourier component has its own sort of Hamiltonian. So if you rewrite this in terms of Fourier components, you get this sort of ladder system where each Fourier component is coupled to its neighbor through these, in this case, dipole matrix elements, right? And everything is separated by h bar times the frequency of your RF field. So that's the flow K theory in a very quick nutshell. And the beautiful thing about this is that now, what do we expect to see when we have this oscillating AC field on there? We expect to see some central state, but then we're expecting also to see off the side of that these sideband states equally spaced by integer multiples of our RF frequency. So this is a quick prediction of the spectrum we'd expect to see with a 30 megahertz field with a DC offset of 1 volt per centimeter and an AC electric field with an amplitude of 2 millivolts per centimeter. You see that we get these, here's our central peak, which is just that DC, or at the energy of the DC Stark effect, but then off to the side, spaced evenly by 30 megahertz, are these sidebands. We can go through some perturbation theory. Fun. I'll just skip through all that. It turns out when you go through some perturbation theory, and you assume a weak field that's time averaging, you can find the amplitude of those sidebands is just really proportional to a Bessel function in this linear dependence in the AC. So this gamma was the slope of that DC Stark effect near my thing. So we can just analytically say exactly what the Rabi frequency to each one of those sidebands is. And it's proportional to just the normal transition frequency times this Bessel function. So, you know, this is now we can go save all the way up to like 5 millivolt per centimeter RF amplitude field. And what I'm showing here is the red line is a massive flow K calculation where I include something like 300 Rydberg states and I think 21 Fourier components in the flow K theory, fully converging it. And then the blue line, which is right on top of it, is the analytic perturbation theory, which is very gratifying for any theorist out there. I remember my E&M professor said, one time in your life, you're gonna get a solution that's a Bessel function, and you're just gonna say, that's lovely, when everyone was complaining about Bessel functions one day. And so that's lovely. It works much better if Chris Green's in the audience, which he's not. So the other nice thing about this is these sideband amplitudes actually have significant modulation as a function of our AC field amplitude. So the strength of these sidebands really varies quite a bit. So they're gonna give us a pretty good marker with that strong dependence on AC field amplitude as a measuring stick for the RF field. And also even better yet, because the sidebands show up at integer multiples of the RF frequency, they also give us frequency resolution at the same time. So two in one, you get not only your amplitude resolution, but also your frequency resolution. Right? Even better yet, you have to go through the full flow K theory. You don't get the perturbation anymore. You can actually even have multiple frequencies all on top of each other. So here I have a central peak, and here I have three different RF fields together, a 30 megahertz, a 47 megahertz, and a 115 megahertz. As long as we have incommensurate RF frequencies, we get sidebands for each set of frequencies that show up. So we can predict what those are and have pretty strong dependence on those. So the sideband is now going to be our method of measuring. In other words, looking at the amplitude of the probability, the transmission rate at the sideband compared to the central transmission rate, right? So how are we gonna actually look at that? We're gonna use EIT, which Luis described. One of the things that's nice about EIT is the width of the transmission window is proportional to the square of our Rabi frequency to the transition. If we now include the sidebands, each sideband is gonna get its own little EIT squiggle. Of course, these little, you know, Fano line shape squiggles on the side, when we're gonna thermal average over them, they sort of disappear. So they're not, it's not especially useful. So what I'm doing here is I'm actually scanning my probe frequency, this 6P transition frequency, and this is the EIT profile that you expect to see. So another option we can do is set the probe to our resonant and scan the control frequency in the upper thing here. So if we scan that, we actually get these very nice sideband transmission windows where the width of the transmission window is proportional to now a Bessel function. Right? So we can exactly calculate the width of these. We can calculate how deep everything is. For instance, here's, again, my 30 megahertz, 1 millivolt per centimeter AC field, 1 volt per centimeter DC offset, the 30 megahertz field, and this is the EIT transmission profile we expect to see for scanning the control field. And of course, we want to do this in a thermal gas. So if we're going to do this in a thermal gas, we're going to use counterpropagating beams, but that since they have different wavelengths, we're going to get an incommensurate wavelength, so we're going to get a little bit of broadening from that. So we need to do a thermal average over the susceptibility over a thermal profile. And doing that, we still can see that we get significant variation and sensitivity to the RF amplitude. So the green dots here are just no RF field, then the blue is at 1 millivolt per centimeter RF field, and the red is a 3 millivolt per centimeter RF field. So you're seeing we get some, at the millivolt per centimeter sort of sensitivity level, we're getting some significant variation in the EIT absorption spectrum. So we think that this is likely to be a very good measuring stick for pretty low amplitude RF fields. We think if we're not caring about frequency resolution, we can go sub millivolt pretty easily. If we want to include frequency resolution, be able to see both frequency and amplitude, we think we can certainly get down to the millivolt per centimeter resolution, maybe better, but who knows? This is just sort of an early proof of principle. So since my experimental colleague isn't here, I'm going to show this is the experimental setup. It just got kind of working a few weeks ago. So there's the EIT setup here. There's every single experimental team needs to have a giant block diagram of what's happening, and that's apparently physics happens in here. That's what I've been told. Okay, and then I just added this one in because there's my little midshipman research student aligning a laser, which is always nice to see a theorist aligning a laser being useful there. And then just this couple weeks ago, they got their first EIT transmission, so here's without the laser, the control laser. Here's with the control laser, and look, oh, there's some transmission right there. So we just got the EIT spectroscopy working. Now it's a matter of getting the RF fields and the DC offsets and all the hard stuff still. So with that, I'll just put up my summary because I went way over time, and there we go.
Are there questions for Seth?
Thank you for the presentation. I just would like to ask if you consider, probably it's a stupid question, if you consider doing the same thing instead of doing the flock K physics, just rely on the Mollel triplet.
On the what?
Mollel triplet. So increase the intensity of your field and you get sideband just because of the Rabi frequency.
Yeah, I mean,
you could do this?
We could do this, but I don't think we'd get the same sort of, we want to look at low intensity. We're looking for very low amplitude fields. We're trying to sense, very.
Okay.
So just a comment. Daniel is here, yes, when he was with us, I think 8 years ago or longer, we were listening to the local radio station at 98.4 megahertz, which is your frequency range. And so sort of it worked much better if you do electric current measurements than looking for the optical signal. It's just a comment. I mean, if you just place some electrodes inside and you measure the current, then Daniel has shown that, orders of magnitude better signal to noise is what you get. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. So everything I've just done is no longer useful. Thank you.
Daniel, do you want to comment? Any other question?
Yeah. Hey, I also wanted to point out that we used a similar technique just with electric contacts on the side of a hollow core fiber. Mm-hmm. And we were also able to resolve the flow K sidebands, mm-hmm. and we could even monitor the filling of the fiber and things like this.
Yeah, so fiber is one way to go. We're right now looking at doing everything in a vapor cell, but the problem with a vapor cell is you get a kind of mono layer of alkali metal on there, and it blocks any external field. So if we want to have that 1 volt per centimeter offset, we're going to have to put the electrodes inside. So fiber is a hollow core fiber is one of the options that we've kind of talked about. It's who knows.
There is no online question. If there's no more questions, then we thank Seth again.